in his own tongue, "What are you doing in the British zone?" He grumbled that it was orders. "Whose orders? Let me see them." I noted the signature. It was useful information. I said, "This tells you to pick up a certain Hungarian national and war criminal who is living with faulty papers in the British zone. Let me see the papers." He started on a long explanation, but I saw the papers sticking in his pocket and I pulled them out. He made a grab at his gun and I punched his face. I felt really mean at doing so, but it's the conduct they expect from an angry officer, and it brought him to reason. That, and seeing three British soldiers approaching his headlights. I said, "These papers look to me quite in order, but I'll investigate them and send a report of the result to your colonel. He can, of course, ask for the extradition of this lady at any time. All we want is proof of her criminal activities. I'm afraid we don't regard Hungarian as Russian nationality." He goggled at me, my Russian was probably half incomprehensible, and I said to Anna, "Get out of the car." She couldn't get by the Russian, so I had to pull him out first. Then I put a packet of cigarettes in his hand, said, "Have a good smoke," waved my hands to the others, gave a sigh of relief, and that incident was closed. While Martins told me how he went back to Anna's and found her gone, I did some hard thinking. I wasn't satisfied with the ghost story, or the idea that the man with Harry Lime's features had been a drunken illusion. I took out two maps of Vienna and compared them. I rang up my assistant and, keeping Martin silent with a glass of whiskey, asked him if he had located Harbin yet. He said no. He understood he'd left Klagenfurt a week ago to visit his family in the adjoining zone. One always wants to do everything oneself. One has to guard against blaming one's juniors. I'm convinced that I would never have let Harbin out of our clutches, but then I would probably have made all kinds of mistakes that my junior would have avoided. "All right," I said. "Go on trying to get hold of him."
"I'm sorry, sir."
"Forget it, it's just one of those things." His young, enthusiastic voice, if only one could still feel that enthusiasm for a routine job. How many opportunities, flashes of insight one misses simply because a job has become just a job, tingled up the wire.
"You know, sir, I can't help feeling that we ruled out the possibility of murder too easily. There are one or two points..."
"Put them on paper, Carter."
"Yes, sir. I think, sir, if you don't mind my saying so..."
Carter is a very young man.
"We ought to have him dug up. There's no real evidence that he died just when the others said..."
"I agree, Carter. Get on to the authorities." Martins was right. I had made a complete fool of myself. But remember that police work in an occupied city is not like police work at home. Everything is unfamiliar. The methods of one's foreign colleagues, the rules of evidence, even the procedure at inquests. I suppose I'd got into the state of mind when one trusts too much to one's personal judgment. I had been immensely relieved by Lime's death. I was satisfied with the accident. I said to Martins, "Did you look inside the kiosk, or was it locked?"
"Oh, it wasn't a newspaper kiosk," he said.
"It was one of those solid iron kiosks you see everywhere plastered with posters. You better show me the place."
"But is Anna all right?"
"The police are watching the flat. They won't try anything else yet." I didn't want to make a fuss in the neighbourhood with a police car, so we took trams, several trams, changing here and there, and came into the district on foot. I didn't wear my uniform, and I doubted anyway, after the failure of the attempt on Anna, whether they would risk a watcher. "This is the turning," Martin said, and led me down a side street. We stopped at the kiosk. "You see, he passed behind here and simply vanished into the ground." "That was exactly where he did vanish to," I said.
"How do you mean?"
An ordinary passerby would never have noticed that the kiosk had a door, and of course it had been dark when the man disappeared. I pulled the door open and showed Martins the little curling iron staircase that disappeared into the ground. He said,
"Good God, then I didn't imagine him."
"It's one of the entrances to the main sewer."
"And anyone can go down?"
"Anyone. For some reason the Russians object to these being locked."
"How far can one go?"
"Right across Vienna. People use them in air raids. Some of our prisoners hid for 2 years down there. Deserters have used them, and burglars. If you know your way about, you can emerge again almost anywhere in the city through a manhole or a kiosk like this one. The Austrians have to have special police for patrolling these sewers." I closed the door of the kiosk again. I said, So that's how your friend Harry disappeared. You really believe it was Harry? The evidence points that way.
Then whom did they bury?
I don't know yet, but we soon shall, because we're digging him up again. I've got a shrewd idea, though, that Koch wasn't the only inconvenient man they murdered. Martin said, "It's a bit of a shock."
Yes.
What are you going to do about it?
I don't know. It's no good applying to the Russians, and you can bet he's hiding out now in the Russian zone. We have no line now on Kurtz, for Harbin's blown. He must have been blown, or they wouldn't have staged that mock death and funeral.
But it's odd, isn't it, that Koch didn't recognize the dead man's face from the window?
The window was a long way up, and I expect the face had been damaged before they took the body out of the car.
He said thoughtfully, "I wish I could speak to him. You see, there's so much I simply can't believe."
"Perhaps you were the only one who could speak to him. It's risky, though, because you know too much."
"I still can't believe. I only saw the face for a moment,"
he said.
"What shall I do?"
"He won't leave the Russian zone now. Perhaps that's why he tried to have the girl taken over. Because he loves her? Because he doesn't feel secure? I don't know. I do know that the only person who could persuade him to come over would be you. Or her, if he still believes you are his friend. But first you've got to speak to him."
"I can't see the line."
"I could go and see Kurtz. I have the address."
I said, "Remember, Lime may not want you to leave the Russian zone when once you're there, and I can't protect you there."
"I want to clear the whole damn thing up," Martin said. "But I'm not going to act as a decoy. I'll talk to him. That's all."
Sunday had laid its false peace over Vienna. The wind had dropped, and no snow had fallen for 24 hours. All the morning trams had been full, going out to Greensing, where the young wine is drunk, and to the slopes of snow on the hills outside. Walking over the canal by the makeshift military bridge, Martins was aware of the emptiness of the afternoon. The young were out with their toboggans and their skis, and all around him was the after-dinner sleep of age. A notice board told him that he was entering the Russian zone, but there were no signs of occupation. You saw more Russian soldiers in the inner city than here. Deliberately, he had given Kurtz no warning of his visit. Better to find him out than a reception prepared for him. He was careful to carry with him all his papers, including the laissez-passer of the four powers, that, on the face of it, allowed him to move freely through all the zones of Vienna. It was extraordinarily quiet over here on the other side of the canal, and a melodramatic journalist had painted a picture of silent terror. But the truth was simply the wider streets, the greater shell damage, the fewer people, and Sunday afternoon. There was nothing to fear. But all the same, in this huge empty street where all the time you heard your own feet moving, it was difficult not to look behind. He had no difficulty in finding Kurtz's block. And when he rang the bell, the door was opened quickly, as though Kurtz expected a visitor, by Kurtz himself.
"Oh," Kurtz said, "it's you, Mr. Martins," and made a perplexed motion with his hand to the back of his head.
Martins had been wondering why he looked so different, and now he knew. Kurtz was not wearing the toupee, and yet his head was not bald. He had a perfectly normal head of hair cut close. He said,
"It would have been better to have telephoned to me. You nearly missed me. I was going out.
May I come in a moment?"
"Of course."
In the hall, a cupboard door stood open, and Martin saw Kurtz's overcoat, his raincoat, a couple of soft hats, and, hanging sedately on a peg like a wrap, Kurtz's toupee. He said, "I'm glad to see your hair has grown," and saw in the mirror on the cupboard door the hatred, flame, and blush on Kurtz's face. When he turned, Kurtz smiled at him like a conspirator, and said vaguely, "It keeps the head warm." "Whose head?" Martins asked, for it had suddenly occurred to him how useful that toupee might have been on the day of the accident. "Never mind," he went quickly on, for his errand was not with Kurtz. "I'm here to see Harry."
"Harry?"
"I want to talk to him."
"Are you mad?"
"I'm in a hurry, so let's assume that I am. Just make a note of my madness. If you should see Harry, or his ghost, let him know that I want to talk to him. A ghost isn't afraid of a man, is it? Surely it's the other way round. I'll be waiting in the Prater by the big wheel for the next 2 hours. If you can get in touch with the dead, hurry. He added, remember, I was Harry's friend. Kurtz said nothing, but somewhere in a room off the hall, somebody cleared his throat. Martins threw open a door. He had half expected to see the dead rise yet again, but it was only Dr. Winkler who rose from a kitchen chair in front of the kitchen stove and bowed very stiffly and correctly with the same celluloid squeak. Dr. Winkle, Martins said. Dr. Winkler looked extraordinarily out of place in a kitchen. The debris of a snack lunch littered the kitchen table, and the unwashed dishes consorted very ill with Dr. Winkler's cleanness. Winkler, the doctor corrected him with stony patience. Martins said to Kurtz, tell the doctor about my madness. He might be able to make a diagnosis. And remember the place by the great wheel. Or do ghosts only rise by night? He left the flat. For an hour he waited, walking up and down to keep warm, inside the enclosure of the great wheel. The smashed Prater, with its bones sticking crudely through the snow, was nearly empty. One stall sold thin flat cakes like cartwheels, and the children queued with their coupons. A few courting couples would be packed together in a single car of the wheel and revolve slowly above the city, surrounded by empty cars. As the car reached the highest point of the wheel, the revolutions would stop for a couple of minutes, and far overhead the tiny faces would press against the glass. Martins wondered who would come for him. Was there enough friendship left in Harry for him to come alone, or would a squad of police arrive? It was obvious from the raid on Anna Schmidt's flat that he had a certain pull. And then, as his watch hand passed the hour, he wondered, was it all an invention of my mind? Are they digging up Harry's body now in the central cemetery? Somewhere behind the cake stall, a man was whistling, and Martins knew the tune. He turned and waited. Was it fear or excitement that made his heart beat? Or just the memories that tune ushered in? For life had always quickened when Harry came. Came just as he came now. As though nothing much had happened. Nobody had been lowered into a grave. Or found with cut throat in a basement. Came with his amused, deprecating, take-it-or-leave-it manner. And of course, one always took it. Harry. Hello, Rollo. Don't picture Harry Lyme as a smooth scoundrel. He wasn't that. The picture I have of him on my files is an excellent one. He is caught by a street photographer with his stocky legs apart, big shoulders a little hunched, a belly that has known too much good food for too long. On his face a look of cheerful rascality, a geniality, a recognition that his happiness will make the world's day. Now he didn't make the mistake of putting out a hand that might have been rejected, but instead just patted Martins on the elbow and said, "How are things?" "We've got to talk, Harry." "Of course." "Alone." "We couldn't be more alone than here." He had always known the ropes, and even in the smashed pleasure park he knew them, tipping the woman in charge of the wheel so that they might have a car to themselves. He said, "Lovers used to do this in the old days, but they haven't the money to spare, poor devils, now." And he looked out of the window of the swaying rising car at the figures diminishing below with what looked like genuine commiseration. Very slowly, on one side of them, the city sank. Very slowly, on the other, the great cross-girders of the wheel rose into sight. As the horizon slid away, the Danube became visible, and the piers of the Reichsbrücke lifted above the houses. "Well," Harry said, "it's good to see you, Rollo." "I was at your funeral." "That was pretty smart of me, wasn't it?" "Not so smart for your girl. She was there too, in tears." "She's a good little thing," Harry said. "I'm very fond of her." "I didn't believe the police when they told me about you." Harry said, "I wouldn't have asked you to come if I'd known what was going to happen. But I didn't think the police were onto me." "Were you going to cut me in on the spoils?" "I've never kept you out of anything, old man, yet," He stood with his back to the door as the car swung upwards, and smiled back at Rollo Martins, who could remember him in just such an attitude in a secluded corner of the school quad, saying,
"I've learned a way to get out at night. It's absolutely safe. You are the only one I'm letting in on it."
For the first time, Rollo Martins looked back through the years without admiration, as he thought, "He's never grown up. Marlowe's devils wore squibs attached to their tails. Evil was like Peter Pan. It carried with it the horrifying and horrible gift of eternal youth." Martin said, "Have you ever visited the children's hospital? Have you seen any of your victims?" Harry took a look at the toy landscape below and came away from the door. "I never feel quite safe in these things," he said. He felt the back of the door with his hand, as though he were afraid that it might fly open and launch him into that iron-ribbed space. "Victims?" he asked. "Don't be melodramatic, Rollo. Look down there," he went on, pointing through the window at the people moving like black flies at the base of the wheel. "Would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I said you can have £20,000 for every dot that stops, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money without hesitation? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spare? Free of income tax, old man. Free of income tax." He gave his boyish conspiratorial smile. "It's the only way to save nowadays. Couldn't you have stuck to tires? Like Cooler? No, I've always been ambitious. You're finished now. The police know everything. But they can't catch me, Rollo. You'll see. I'll pop up again. You can't keep a good man down." The car swung to a standstill at the highest point of the curve, and Harry turned his back and gazed out of the window. Martins thought, "One good shove and I could break the glass." And he pictured the body falling through the iron struts, a piece of carrion dropping among the flies. He said, "You know the police are planning to dig up your body. What will they find?" "Harbin," Harry replied with simplicity. He turned away from the window and said, "Look at the sky." The car had reached the top of the wheel and hung there motionless, while the stain of the sunset ran in streaks over the wrinkled, papery sky beyond the black girders. "Why did the Russians try to take Anna Schmidt? She had false papers, old man." "Who told them?" "The price of living in this zone, Rollo, is service. I have to give them a little information now and then. I thought perhaps you were just trying to get her here because she was your girl, because you wanted her." Harry smiled. "I haven't all that influence." "What would have happened to her?" "Nothing very serious. She'd have been sent back to Hungary. There's nothing against her, really. A year in a labor camp, perhaps. She'd be infinitely better off in her own country than being pushed around by the British police." "She hasn't told them anything about you." "She's a good little thing," Harry repeated, with satisfaction and pride. "She loves you." "Well, I gave her a good time while it lasted." "And I love her." "That's fine, old man. Be kind to her. She's worth it. I'm glad." He gave the impression of having arranged everything to everybody's satisfaction. "And you can help to keep her mouth shut. Not that she knows anything that matters. I'd like to knock you through the window, but you won't, old man. Our quarrels never last long. You remember that fearful one in the Monaco, when we swore we were through? I'd trust you anywhere, Rollo. Kurtz tried to persuade me not to come, but I know you. Then he tried to persuade me to, well, arrange an accident. He told me it would be quite easy in this car. Except that I'm the stronger man. But I've got the gun. You don't think a bullet wound would show when you hit that ground?" Again the car began to move, sailing slowly down, until the flies were midgets, were recognizable human beings. "What fools we are, Rollo, talking like this, as if I'd do that to you. Or you to me." He turned his back and leaned his face against the glass. "One thrust. How much do you earn a year with your westerns, old man?"
"£1,000.
"Taxed. I earn £30,000 free. It's the fashion.
In these days, old man,